From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The containment of COVID-19 in New Zealand has been the envy of much of the world. The country locked down early and hard before cases hit triple figures, embracing the goal of elimination, in contrast to Scott Morrison's policy of suppression. For a time, COVID apparently had been eliminated in that country, but then there was a small outbreak which grew. Nevertheless, such a record on the health front will play into Jacinda Ardern's hand in the mid-October election. Ardern is riding incredibly high in the polls against the National Party and its new leader, Judith Collins. On the downside, however, the economy has paid a heavy price for the health success, with more than 12% contraction in quarterly GDP, much bigger than Australia has suffered. Today we talk with Helen Clark, a former Labor Prime Minister of New Zealand, who has become very active on the international stage over recent years. Clark has been prominent in the United Nations bodies and is a strong voice on the issues of climate change, gender equality, and women's leadership. Currently, Clark is co-chair of the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response, the group that was set up by the World Health Organization to prepare for the handling of pandemics in the future, grounded in the lessons from this one. This inquiry followed the call by Australia and other countries for an investigation into the origins and handling of COVID-19. Helen Clark, how broad is the COVID inquiry and what's the balance between looking back and looking forward?
The inquiry is set up by the world's health ministers meeting at the World Health Assembly to look at the internationally coordinated response by WHO to the pandemic. Now, that, of course, could be very wide if you decided to look at how every country responded, and we don't really have the wherewithal to interview 193 countries in depth. But we are asked to look at how the emergencies program of the WHO worked. What about the state of the international health regulations? Have there been improvements suggested in the past which have never been acted on? How has the WHO worked with other parts of the international system? So all of that is set out in the resolution. What we want to do is establish authoritatively what happened and when. We want to distill lessons from that as to what perhaps could have been done better. And we want to make practical recommendations. We don't want fluffy recommendations. We want things that could be implemented.
So will the inquiry get right back to the origins of the outbreak? Will we know, as well as it's possible to know, just when and how and where this occurred?
We don't envisage the inquiry doing a forensic epidemiological investigation into where the virus actually came from. In the sense, did it come straight from a bat? Where did it come from? But what we do want to know is, when was it first known about? When was that notified to relevant authorities? How did they react? We want to establish a good timeline, because that will tell us whether there are gaps in the way the international system is able to respond.
And in terms of how it's being conducted, it's presumably all virtual. Are there difficulties with that? How thorough can you be? Are you holding hearings? What form do they take?
Certainly we can hold hearings virtually. We can also solicit evidence and submissions. It's not that easy for any of us to travel at the moment. My co-chair is sitting in her capital city in Liberia. I'm sitting in Auckland, New Zealand. But our lives have all reoriented during this period of the pandemic to working virtually. So I don't think that will be a significant constraint.
Now, the inquiry reports in May. Given the politics that surrounded its establishment, can people be confident that it will be full and frank in its assessment? You've said you don't want fluffy recommendations, but will they be tough assessments and recommendations?
this is not a normal member state selected kind of panel. This is an independent panel where we looked at what skills we would need on it and then looked out around the world to see who could contribute to that. We had our first meeting, full meeting, last Thursday, and my impression is that this is a pretty independent-minded bunch, and they are going to want to put their name to something that will tell truth to power and make strong recommendations. That's certainly something that I as a co-chair would like to see, but I think there's an appetite for that on the panel.
And just precisely how were they selected and what's the range of skills in broad terms?
We did ask member states if they would like to make nominations, and a number did, but we did not restrict ourselves to those nominations. What we said is we need a mix of people. We would obviously like some with some experience of responding to such an emergency in the past, health professional skills are desirable, but we also wanted people with insights into economics, into geopolitics and diplomacy. We specifically recruited a youth representative to bring the perspectives of young people. So it's quite a broad and multi-skilled panel.
Did Australia show any interest in being part of the panel, given its early advocacy of the inquiry?
Oh, definitely. Australia's been very interested. And we have had very good support from Australia for the work of the panel. I've personally spoken with Foreign Minister Maurice Payne, and really she couldn't have been more helpful and more supportive.
If we can move domestically, you've got a very interesting election coming up in October. In June, your former Chief of Staff, Helen Simpson, prepared a review of the New Zealand health and disability system, which called for structural and other changes within the health industry. Is it your opinion, if COVID had hit New Zealand harder, the health infrastructure would have been found wanting?
I think if COVID had hit New Zealand hard, we would have struggled like we see our friends in the United Kingdom are struggling, our friends in the United States struggling, our friends in every other developed country, perhaps apart from Japan, struggling. Because if that pandemic gets away on a country, the crush on the hospitals becomes very, very serious indeed. So it would have been a huge problem. And I think one of the reasons that Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern got so much support for the measures that she took was that by the time she took them, we could see what was happening on our television screens, particularly in Spain and Italy. And New Zealanders were thinking, we don't want that here. We don't want to see this affect our older people, our vulnerable, our people with pre-existing health conditions. This could be any of us. It could be our families. It could be our best friends. So people were prepared to knuckle down and help fight this as the team of 5 million, as it was put, because we knew what things could be like if we didn't.
Is the health system much of an issue in the upcoming election?
The health system as such, I would say no. In my experience, every election in New Zealand has had health as an issue, because people want to talk about waiting lists and particular aspects of services, whether it's cancer or whether it's mental health. But in a way, this election is all about COVID, how it's been handled, how we need to act as a country going forward. Speaking to candidates out there on the ground from my own party, that's what they're saying. People are only talking about.
New Zealand's paid a high economic price for its hard lockdown. How much of a reaction has there been against that? Have people been more concerned with the threat to their health than with the economic consequences?
Obviously, there's some political debate about that. But my impression as we speak is that New Zealanders are putting the highest priority on the community being safe from COVID. Now, it's fair to say that to a large extent, job subsidies and small business and other subsidies are still running. If that wasn't the case, perhaps the debate would shift a little. But I think also New Zealanders are cognizant that if you get the public health response wrong, the economic damage can be longer and deeper. And I'll be interested to see the comparison over a year between New Zealand and Australia, because we did go very hard very early, and we haven't had a major shutdown since that of, say, the Victoria style. We did have the new cases appear in Auckland again in August, as I recall. But we did not go back to a very hard lockdown. We managed it at a lower level of lockdown. And I hope going forward with the measures that can be put in place, it could be managed in future at a lower level still. But I have to repeat, people are very risk averse about COVID here at the moment.
In Australia, we've seen a debate increasingly emerge with a number of economists, most particularly right-leaning economists, saying that the economic price has been too high, that we should talk in terms of evaluating really the value of lives, the young against the old, and so on. Have you had that sort of debate in New Zealand?
There's a bit of that, and as you say, from a particular part of the political spectrum. But I think in New Zealand, there is a very high value put on human life and health. And it would be seen by most people as unconscionable just to let the pandemic rip or to do very little to mitigate. In the first round of the appearance of it, it was largely affecting those who came back to New Zealand from travel, and they tended to be, for the most part, a younger and fitter demographic, and where it was older generations, also largely, you know, the fit and energetic who'd been on their, you know, overseas trips. Now, where we got tragedy in that lockdown was in the rest home sector, and the majority of our deaths in that first round, the 22 to 23 deaths were there or among older people. But with this latest outbreak, it has occurred in Pacifica and Māori communities where there's a high prevalence of non-communicable diseases. And we've had, out of the relatively small number of cases now, three deaths. So people feel that. And I think, again, very risk-averse, not wanting to see the pandemic get away and hurt vulnerable demographics.
In July, you were one of three co-authors of a paper saying New Zealand needs to start to have a process of re-engaging with the world, that is, opening its border. Now, Jacinda Ardern won't commit to a timetable for opening the border while her opponent in the election wants to do so. How important do you think this issue of border opening will be in the election?
Well, I don't support, you know, quote, opening the border right now. And the re-engaging the world document was about how do we move forward in a more sustainable way? Because we have a choke point. We have an official quarantine system which has struggled to accommodate the numbers of returning New Zealanders and returning permanent residents, let alone accommodate the people needed for essential skills in the workplace or giving any consideration to the return of international students or tourists. So this is not sustainable on a long-term basis. So what we need to do here, and again, looking at best practice elsewhere, and one has to say that that Taiwan doesn't do too badly as one example, we desperately need the implementation of Bluetooth technology for contact tracing. I think consideration needs to be given to requiring testing before departure for New Zealand, which wouldn't pick up every case, but would pick up soon. We would need to have a look at to what extent safe corridors, safe bubbles could operate. You know, none of this is easy at the moment, not even with our nearest and closest neighbours like Australia. But going forward, we will have to expand the quarantine provision. Otherwise, we will be limiting our possibilities.
Well, your economy is so dependent on tourism, isn't it, that it becomes unsustainable beyond a certain point to close off from the world?
So here's the rub. With the effective ending in March of international tourism and international education, we lost 25%. It's a full quarter of our export dollar earnings, 20.4% of it, tourism, and the rest made up with the international education. Now, that's not going to be easily replaced. And it's also fair to say that a lot of people are saying it gives us the opportunity to rethink the shape of those industries. There's a feeling that there was a focus on volume rather than value, and that New Zealand has a unique product in tourism and shouldn't be underselling it. So I doubt that you'll see a rush back to the kind of tourism that we had, even if borders were able to safely reopen. So tourism will reposition, I think, around a higher value product and visitor. And international education probably will too. I think one can see ways in which the students could return to the degree granting institutions, but whether they will ever return to the proliferation of lower cost, lower quality schools in the shorter term course English education is another matter.
Would you like to see the border open, say, for Christmas? And what about the Australia-New Zealand bubble? How quickly do you think we might see that?
I don't think the border could be open for Christmas. And I'm in the school of thought that says a vaccine as a silver bullet isn't going to give us sufficient protection anytime soon. The most optimistic forecasts, leaving aside what's said in American political debate, rather later next year, others, which may be more realistic, are saying later on 2022. Others are saying 4 years. Look, it's not tomorrow. So the borders won't be safely open at Christmas. Will there be a trans-Tasman bubble? At the moment, we don't see that either. If Australia had firm borders at its state level, you could have had bubbles with New Zealand and Australian states, but that's not the way the Australians have dealt with it, and that, of course, is absolutely their prerogative. There's clearly a great desire in the Pacific to have safe travel resume with New Zealand, but the outbreak we had in August paid to that for a little while as well.
Is opening the borders compatible with a zero community transmission policy? And indeed, is the New Zealand policy of elimination, which I presume you're still committed to even though you've had this later outbreak, do you think that's sustainable in the long term?
I describe the approach being taken here more as one of zero tolerance. I accept, and I think many people looking at the experience of COVID accept, that it is very difficult to stop it popping up, even when you think you've eradicated every case in the country. It's so transmissible that one wrong finger on a lift button can start a chain again. So the approach here is to do whatever you can to stop it escaping the border. But where it does and you see it, you stamp on it, you squash it. And this is why introducing Bluetooth technology will be part of strong and sustainable approaches going forward over and above the current apps and contact tracing systems. So here, as I say, risk averse, wanting it stamped out when it appears so that the rest of us can carry on and lead as much of a normal life as is possible.
Now, just returning specifically to the election, you've got a couple of interesting referendum questions that New Zealanders will be voting on together with their election choice. One is the legalisation of cannabis, and the other is for an end-of-life choice act that's been passed to come into effect for euthanasia. You've gone on the record that policing cannabis is a waste of taxpayers' money. What could the legalisation mean for New Zealand, and do you think it will get through?
Legalisation would bring significant economic benefit. For a start, you would stop wasting the $200 million a year the New Zealand police spend trying to enforce prohibition to no effect whatsoever. Cannabis has been very widely available in New Zealand for many decades and will continue to be whatever the state of the law is. I often say to people, the referendum is not about whether you think cannabis should be available in New Zealand. It is available. It's a question about the terms on which it's available. Do you let it continue to prosper in an underground economy which is never taxed and is completely unregulated and there's no control over what the content is? Or do you vote for a legal market where you don't waste money on law and order costs and you take from that? Economists who've been forecasting on tax take are giving estimates of anything upwards of $490 million a year. Add to that the $200 million you save on the police. Add somewhat more for the costs of the courts and the prison system. I'd be very surprised if we weren't $750 million a year better off. And in a COVID-stressed economy, you know, that's important money. I know that ACT in Australia has actually moved ahead of New Zealand on this. If we can keep up with ACT by voting yes in the referendum, I'll be very happy.
And what do you think on euthanasia? Do you think that will be endorsed?
The polling on euthanasia has consistently suggested a rather large margin of support for that. Now, again, as with cannabis, there's the usual fear and scare and, you know, knocking campaign, but I don't think it will knock it off course. Clearly, the cannabis one is closer, but it can be won. It will be very dependent on turnout, particularly of young voters and those who are often not so motivated to vote, but where this is an issue that they care about.
Now, this is not the first election in New Zealand with two female leaders going head-to-head. Indeed, you were in a similar contest in one of your elections. Does this make a difference, however, in policy or style?
Yes, it's quite challenging. And I recall that 1999 election when I went head-to-head with then-Prime Minister Jenny Shipley. And to use a ghastly phrase, in a way, there's nothing that a lot of observers would like more than to see the two of you descend into some kind of, quote, catfight or jelly wrestle. And I think Jenny and I managed to keep it well above that level. And watching Jacinda Ardern and Judith Collins last night, I think it's also fair to say that they kept it well above that level. They are so different in style. They're a generation apart, Jacinda 40, Judith 61, very different style, but they didn't descend into pettiness of the kind that you can see in such debates. So I think the women leaders feel a real onus not to get down into the gutter, if you like.
This election, however, is one that's being conducted in such extraordinary times. How is the conduct of the campaign different from the past?
The outbreak, again, of COVID in August placed quite significant constraints on the Labor Party. Was rather lucky that they had their major opening in the Auckland Town Hall before the outbreak. Unfortunately, the National Party, which had programmed their launch later, wasn't so lucky, and they had to proceed in a different way. So it has been a constraint. And, of course, in Auckland, we still have controls on the size and nature of meetings. I'm doing a debate, for example, next week on cannabis. The maximum size of the gathering can be 100, and there will have to be physical distancing. If I did it elsewhere in New Zealand, as I did last night in Wellington, that doesn't apply. But we are working around those kinds of constraints.
Has this little second wave, if we can call it that, played into the election debate? Is there any sort of backlash against the government over that because they said, well, we're on top of the virus and suddenly you weren't quite?
Yes, I think it has had an impact. And, of course, in an open democratic society like New Zealand, any shortcoming at the border or in any official action will get a lot of focus and attention from both media and opposition, and that's as it should be. So it may have taken a little off the shine off, but overall, I think we would have to say the momentum is with Jacinda Ardern and the government. The opposition leader put on a good performance last night in the debate, and that can shore up support a bit, which was badly bleeding. But the debate was preceded by a poll from the major TV channel which was sponsoring the debate, which had a very, very large lead for Labor. And, you know, with just over 20 days to go, it's hard to see that eroding now.
Now, just finally, in broad terms, how has COVID changed the politics of New Zealand, indeed the New Zealand community, society, and is the change for the better or for the worse?
Well, I'm inclined to think it's for the better because it has got us thinking about our responsibility to each other, that as a society we have to pull together at times like this, and by and large we have. You know, as I say, the opposition has a role to play, but it has played that role for the most part, you know, responsibly. It's debated around the edges, but it hasn't questioned the basic strategy of trying to keep New Zealanders safe. So it is as if we've discovered a higher value, which is a threat to one as a threat to all. I think it has made it harder for the opposition when something like this happens and the government has to take command and lead a country through. If it does that in a credible way, which it has here, that clearly strengthens the government. But I think Jacinda Ardern has been very, very careful not to play politics with this. If out of it, you know, is that we come out with a New Zealand which is kinder and more inclusive, then that would be a positive thing.
Helen Clark, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today, and good luck with that very difficult inquiry. That's all from our podcast. We'll be back with another interview soon. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.